This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much. Thank you for attending the afternoon plenary. There is no title to this plenary session, but three traits unite the two speakers, Ma Jun and Orville Schell. They are both very involved in issues involving water and the environment. They are both very involved, of course, in China. And they both have a background in and a continuing involvement with journalism. I'm going to introduce Ma Jun first, just tell you about him, and then he will speak for about a half hour, and then I'll introduce Orville, who will follow. Ma Jun is a leading Chinese investigative journalist and environmentalist. He worked at the South China Morning Post in the 1990s, where he wrote a number of feature articles on the Chinese environment. He wrote a book, China's Water Crisis, that came out in 1999, and it was a national call for environmental protection of water resources. Realizing that access to information was a prerequisite for public participation in pollution control, Ma founded the Institute of Public and Environmental Environmental Affairs in 2006. He's the recipient of the prestigious 2012 Goldman Environmental Prize for Asia, which honors environmental heroes from around the globe for their efforts to protect the natural world. Ma Jun, thanks.
Thank you, John, for your gracious introduction, and I appreciate this opportunity to come back to this great university. And today I want to share with you some of the water challenges in our country, which is quite a direct one, and also share with you some of the efforts made in our part of the world, and I particularly want to highlight some of the opportunities for all of us to come to work together to address those issues. The last 30 years have seen tremendous growth in our country, but this massive growth have also put a lot of pressure on our fragile environment and ecosystem. When it comes to water, there are three major water challenges: water pollution, water shortage, and also the degradation of our water ecosystem. When it comes to pollution, many of our rivers and lakes have been contaminated like this. You know, the Lake Tai, Lake Chao, and Lake Dianshi, and we have seen very persistent water pollution. And it's not just the rivers and lake, it's not just the surface water, but the groundwater as well. The recent revelation of the fact that about more than 50% of the monitored wells in nearly 200 cities have been found either bad or very bad, and the water quality have aroused a lot of concerns because, you know, groundwater is being used for drinking and also for farming in many parts of China. And pollution, when it comes to pollution, of course, the biggest impact biggest hazards, it will be on public health when 300 million rural residents still don't have access to sufficient safe drinking water, and when increasingly the urban the drinking water source for our cities have been contaminated, and there's definitely a health concerns behind that, and also because of the irrigation of all this water, wasted water. I mean, some of the wastewater even be used for irrigation and unsafe disposal of all this hazardous waste. Our soil contamination is getting serious, and every year we got 12 million tons of crops contaminated by heavy metals, and that raised a lot of concerns over food safety. And obviously, such a widespread water pollution have also threatened our social stability. You know, every year we got all these so-called collective incidents occurring in different parts of China. And water shortage is equally bad. And two-thirds of our cities are in shortage of water. They are it's particularly serious in some northern parts of China where the per capita availability have dropped to dangerously low level. Like in my city, Beijing, the per capita availability it has dropped below 120 cubic meters. And a large part of the North China now is eyeing for the help from the south. Two canals, each of them 1,200 kilometers long, are under construction, are near its completion. So from next year, we're going to have water transferred from the Yangtze River tributary to the to Beijing and to many other northern cities. But the Yangtze River is in its own trouble. Although, despite the fact that it has huge volume, the third largest volume among all the rivers in the world, still 40% of our wastewater got dumped in this watershed, and some of the tributaries have been quite contaminated. And over-exploitation, it's not just a water diversion project, and long before that, we have this over-exploitation by the large damming project going on, and especially in the Yangtze River Valley. Now, I just showed a few big dams, and actually, you know, the Three Gorges Dam behind that, you know, we got all this major dams planned or under construction on the mainstream, and hundreds of them are being built on the tributaries, causing a serious threat to the ecosystem. And climate change obviously adds a lot of uncertainties on all this water supply issues. And as pointed out this morning by Peter Glicks, and we in China, I think there is a recognition that we need to extend, we need to shift our priority from the expansion of supply to water conservation. And during the past 10 years, I think there's a lot of policy shift, and the rhetoric have changed dramatically. And we set three major lines for water use, you know, on total supply, efficiency, and water quality by the highest government in China. But having said that, despite all these efforts, all the resources, we still haven't seen the turning point. When we try to understand what are the real barriers, it's not just the technology, it's not just even money. We believe it's the motivation that is the number one barrier. The lack of motivation is there because our enforcement of laws and regulations remains to be weak. Our environmental litigation in China is still very, very difficult. Water, particularly, you know, the water price is kept artificially low, and all this have taken away the motivations. Many of this water, major water users, the factories, they would rather pay fines year after year without solving the problem. They would rather use fresh water instead of recycle and reuse the water. So how do we change that? Behind that is very, very profound, you know, reasons that the local government officials still put GDP growth rate ahead of environmental protection. So very difficult to change. We believe that we need extensive public participation to try to solve the problem. But people need to be informed before they got involved. So with that in mind, we built a national water pollution database for giving people access to the water information for all the 31 provinces and more than 280 cities in our country. The water quality data, the amount of discharge like this, like the total waste, the for every specific water pollutants, and try to give people access to water quality maps, which color the rivers according to their quality. And in some of our areas, you could see, in the North China Plain, it's not just the availability have dropped to a very low level, and also the water the quality. On the left-hand side, you could see, more than half of the rivers have been degraded to the level that it's good for no use, the quality. So Hai River, Huai River, and the Liao River, and this is the Yellow River. You could also see some of the tributaries have been degraded to a level that is good for no use. And not just in the north, but in the south, this Lake Tai region, it's not the lake itself got contaminated. It's all these rivers that feed into that. Nearly 45% of that have been in the worse than Category 5, meaning that they are basically useless water. But millions of people lived in all this watershed. So, and also try to highlight the fact that the water pollution have been extended from the land to the seas. When all these pollutants got carried into our by the rivers into our coastal seas, and people could see the dark purple color means that the seawater is good for new use. But we're not just try to expose the issues. We try to really need to solve the problem. And I think the key method is to try to identify the sources of all this pollution. And with that in mind, we compile all this government monitoring and enforcement data we started with 2,500 records of violations, and today that has topped 130,000. Of course, when it comes to sources, there are industrial discharge. It's still quite significant. We have all these factories which cannot meet the discharge standards. And urban sewage is another source of water pollution. And we also collect their enforcement monitoring data, and thousands of them cannot also meet the standards. And also the livestock farms is a major water pollution source in the countryside. And people sometimes this just shows that they do feel helpless, when it comes to cases in probably heard about that in Shanghai, all these dead pigs, and so all these are major sources, and so all this information have become increasingly available. But how to translate that from into action, how to motivate people. A group of NGOs have come together in 2007 and formed a Green Choice Alliance, calling upon the consumers to pay attention to the corporate behavior and try to use their buying power to urge major brands to green their supply chain in China. Today, that Green Choice Alliance have been extended from 21 to 46. And the idea is to go methodology is to use what we can mobilize the limited but consistent the consumer power to go through the brands and then try to influence large number of their suppliers, try to have the major brands to commit not to source from polluters in China. But before, they have the excuse that we don't know who are polluting, who are not. So when we come to China, we just buy from the cheapest. But now that's no longer true. Type in the keyword of any given supplier, they could pull out the pollution records in our database. And there's a group of companies who kind of started doing that from the early days. But not all the brands are so willing to face all this data because it's still about it's very much about cost. Many of them would say that we don't want to touch it because all this issues behind that could be really big and costly to fix. So we believe we need to engage not just individual brands, but try to engage the industry. With that in mind, we started engaging with the IT industry in 2010. After months of engagement, 28 out of 29 say that, started some recognition and some dialogue with the NGOs, but there's one brand at that time, which is Apple, which claimed that they have a long-term policy not to disclose the supply chain. So even with very specific findings of the polluting suppliers, so we have to delve deeper into this case, and through the investigation, we found that when the demand picked up, when the supply chain got extended, we do have not just the pollution got extended, but people, the communities are really suffering from all this pollution, and with the report, with the videos posted on social media, published on internet, and we do have the active consumers, the young people. They took their action and calling for the greening of the cell phone. Many of them write letters to the company saying, "I love your product, but I can't accept the fact that you don't want to handle the issue of water pollution. The pollution discharge." So we witnessed the pollution, during this process. In this case, on this lake, the lake got so much contaminated. Not just it looks extremely murky and almost like a Milky Way, but also, through our testings, heavy metals got into the sediment. We found that probably, for decades, the problem will persist and cannot be resolved. But then, through all these efforts, eventually, Apple turned around and started discussion and started driving, use their buying power to motivate their suppliers. After 1 year and a half of waiting and silence, and eventually they started showing their motivation power. And in this case, the company, the factory, the supplier, not just fixed their problems on the ground, lining and stop all this heavy metal discharge on the ground, but also on site. But also they dredged the lake, and actually, it's quite a engineering wonder how they, managed to try to get rid of all these metals from the sediment. So remarkable cleaning up. And today, Apple and many other brands are using the data to track the performance of their supply chain, regularly compare their list with our list, and also, when it comes to Apple, they integrate their system. Our management, our system, and into their management system, and try to use the Green Choice Alliance protocol in auditing and dividing NGOs and even local representatives to monitor the all this audit conducted by third party by the professionals. And so when the IT industry is moving forward, we move into the second industry, the textile industry, and try to engage with different brands. This industry is generating 2.5 billion tons of wastewater, much of that not properly treated, and causing a very big water impact in some of the regions in China, densely populated regions in our country. And when they claim that they move into sustainable apparel, we highlight that they actually got a critical blind spot because they had just handled a tier one supplier, while the die houses are the real problem. And some of them claim they have zero waste policy and all this, but in reality they don't even know who are their die houses are, and the die house generate more than 80% of all this waste. And so through all this efforts, companies like Marks and Spencer and others, at the beginning they don't quite recognize this issue, but gradually they understand with after we published our two reports on this, and eventually some of them have turned to good practice, and companies like Nike, like H&M, they move forward and manage to mobilize hundreds of their suppliers to take corrective actions. So together, with our partners, we managed to study our ranking, and we assessed their performance in their supply chain management, how responsible they manage their supply chain, started with compliance, but moved to data disclosure and extension into upstream, identify the key areas of impact. So different companies, these are the top 40 some companies which are doing some of the work, but we still have huge gaps there. So some of them still don't quite want to face all this issue, even with the solid data available. So with that, we are trying to get seek partnership with our partners in. With the NGOs in this part of the world, try to develop the ranking into a assessment tool, into a index with China perspective, and try to together with our partners here, and all this have motivated efforts have motivated, as I said, many companies to on the list have started coming to the NGOs. Most of them explain what went wrong, how they try to fix their problem, providing all this documents and monitoring data, which they used to take as their confidential information. And some of them started opening their door to invite local people and local communities and NGOs to start to conduct third-party audit and with a report fully published, of course, taking out all this confidential commercial secret part. And today, more than 1,000 of these factories responded, and all their response, all their feedback are publicly available on our website. Having said that, there are still more than 100,000 of them in our database, and this probably still just the tip of the iceberg, considering the limited disclosure in China. So we definitely need to scale up all these efforts in our country. We need to find more levers, like leverage, such as the investment and the to have the public go through the investors and listed companies to try to influence the polluting factories. So we developed another tool which allows the investors to type in the ticker code and pull out all these pollution records of the more than 900 listed companies in China. And in increasingly going to be listed, those companies listed abroad but have operations in China. But fundamentally, I think all this corrective actions are based on the extension of transparency, and started with government transparency. But we trust that we need to move, we need to extend that to the corporate disclosure. And just like in this part of the world, which started the toxic release inventory in the late 1980s, and I had the honor to meet with Lisa Jackson and Minister Jackson talked about all the success about the Community Rights to Know Act, you know, how important that is in combating the pollution in America. And we study also the pollution release and transfer registry in Europe, and increasingly has been extended to Canada, to Australia, even our neighbors like Japan and Korea. But now China has discharged more of this this waste. You know, we are the factory of the world, and our factories still don't have to disclose all this very important data, and which is important to the local communities. It's still huge gaps here, and some of our partners, you know, one by one, they're not satisfied. They decided to take their own actions to try to help identify all these sources. So one by one, you know, they are. We launched a take a picture and locate a polluter program, so they can use their smartphone to take a picture and upload that on the Chinese social media, and then through that we can locate all these polluters on the digital map. Altogether, 15,000 of polluters, you know, among millions of polluting sources, this 15,000 discharge more than 65% of the wastewater, water emission, and air emission, and heavy metals. So we need to prioritize on this. We don't, you know, not just where they are, but our dream is that, you know, pushing for a expansion of disclosure based on this. And so from the March of this year, 26 NGOs, including us, launched a total transparency initiative calling for the government to push for a total disclosure of all this enforcement data, monitoring data, including the real-time disclosure of the online monitoring data. China spent huge amount of resources to install all this online monitoring, so far not shared with the public. So we hope that every hour, you know, the public can access this information. It's strategically very important. And, of course, the PRTR system need to be built up, and the disclosure of the full EIA report. So with all this, the dream is that, you know, on a digital map, people can access information, not just who they are, but where they are, and the discharge volume, whether they are in compliance with all the standards, and the every hour, you know, what are the emission, air emission, and water emission data. And I want to close by just saying that our challenges when it comes to water pollution, our challenges are real, and it's severe. It matters not just to this generation, but the generations to come. When we laid all these toxics and metals into our waterways, you know, get into the aquifer, the soil, it will take generations to really try to solve the problem. And we still have gaps in our governance, in our management, the weak enforcement, the high difficulties in environmental lawsuit, all this are our gaps. But we have made some social progress in China. The rising public awareness, the expansion of government transparency, and the increasingly more active social NGOs, and China's own foundations. All this have created a possibility for us to form to transform our top-down environmental decision making and management system into a more open and participatory governance, where the government, corporations, and public can come to work together. And through the talk, I believe that you have also seen, you know, some of these issues are not just you know, it's our own issue. You know, when it comes to water, it's very local, but it's also part of this global big picture. You know, we have the supply chain. You know, China as the manufacturer workshop of the world. You know, all these brands, the IT, the textile, and the future other industries are, I think, you know, all of you probably, you know, in your life could have some something to do with those brands, and also the, you know, this today we had so much discussion about climate change, and the very fact is that China burns half of the world's coal. I think if we don't do something, that the projection is that the consumption going to double by 2040. So I think that's the big picture that we have to, you know, face. And I think there are chances for us to come together, you know, taking advantage of the increasing available data. I mean, from the country as close as China, I mean, a country even like China, you know, there are all this data available. And if we can come together to make our joint efforts, I think there's still a possibility for us to solve all these serious local and global environmental challenges. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Marjan, for a, a very, very clear, graphic, comprehensive description of water quality issues in China. We're going to turn to our second speaker, Orville Schell. Let me say a few words about Orville. Many of you know him from his days at Berkeley. Orville is the Arthur Ross Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York. He's a former professor and dean at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. He was born in New York City, graduated magna cum laude from Harvard in Far Eastern history, was an exchange student at National Taiwan University in the 1960s, and earned his doctorate at UC Berkeley in Chinese history. He worked for the Ford Foundation in Indonesia, covered the war in Indochina as a journalist, and has traveled widely in China since the mid-70s. And it's a real pleasure to introduce Orville Schell.
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be back here at Berkeley, and all the more so to be here with Ma Yun, who's an old friend, and who, for those of you who may not know too much about him, has been for a long time really on the cutting edge of this very interesting, expanding world of civil society that's been in a state of tension with the government, but sometimes a constructive tension. And as you can see, there's much to be done in that country in terms of environmental cleanup. You know, I landed today, I flew in from China this morning, and when I left, it was one of those days when you could hardly see the end of your nose. You've all been reading about the air pollution, and it is very disturbing, one aspect of the whole mosaic of problems that have extended from China's very dynamic development. But actually, it's not something that worries me quite as much as the whole question of carbon emissions. You may wonder, how can I say that? And looking at what Majin confronts every day in water pollution, breathing the air, everybody's wearing masks now. There's a huge run in cities of North China and elsewhere that are polluted on air purifiers, air filters for cars, for apartments, which of course just makes more pollution. But how could one say that they're not particularly worried about it? Well, for the following reason. The truth is, we know how to clean these things up. I grew up in New York. As a kid, every morning you'd wake up, there'd be a layer of grit, of soot on the windowsill, because we burn coal. London was one of the most suffocating cities of the world as a result of the Industrial Revolution and burning coal. Los Angeles, you remember Los Angeles? used to have horrendous air pollution from automobiles. So it is within the scientific ability of the world to clean up these kinds of conventional pollutants. And I do believe that China, because it has a rather extraordinary organizational capacity, and it recognizes now this is a challenge of monumental proportions, will do that. What worries me infinitely more is something I want to share a few thoughts with you about now, and that is the rather horrific prospect of increased carbon emissions and the way in which that leads to climate change, and how in a very fragile environment like China, where there is, you know, a quarter of the world's population on 7% of the arable land, it's a very delicate balance. And one area that I want to just speak to you about, really almost metaphorically, is this vast area that, called the Tibetan Plateau. Now, it used to be, you know, this was an area of great mystery, enchantment. Why? Because it was hard to get there. Nobody wanted you to go there. But it was what the Brits used to call a blank place on the map. It was a place that excited the imagination of explorers because it was so remote and so few people lived there. Lhasa, the great mystical city that begged so many people to try to reach it. It now turns out, in its modern guise, that the Tibetan Plateau is a place of incomparable importance. Why? Because if you look at any of the maps you've been seeing, and Majun showed many, every major river system of Asia finds its headwaters in this very remote region that begins above Afghanistan. The Hindu Kush, this majestic range of mountains that arcs around, sort of above Pakistan, India, the Karakoram Range, heads into the Himalaya Range, which then bends upward back of Yunnan Province and Sichuan Province, the Hengduan Range, and other mountains that head north. And it is behind that great rim of the 14 tallest peaks in the world that the Tibetan Plateau, which is bigger than all of Europe, lies. And one of the sources of the water for the rivers which come down, the Amu Darya, the Indus, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Salween, the Irrawaddy, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Yellow River. I mean, just think about it. That is one hell of a network of rivers. And they all begin in this very strange, remote piece of real estate at the top of the world, what was known as the roof of the world. Now, what makes those rivers behave in significant measure as they have behaved for centuries and centuries and centuries are the ice systems, the glaciers, that are within this great arc of mountains. And what those glaciers have done traditionally is to serve as reservoirs. They freeze water. Snow falls, it gets compacted into ice, and it sits there sometimes for millennia before it gets released. But it gets released into these various river systems at critical times, before and after the monsoon. So it isn't that a very preponderant proportion or percentage of the flow of all of these rivers comes from glaciers. But a very important part seasonally, what they call shoulder seasons, when monsoons have stopped or monsoons haven't started, it kind of evens the flow out. And all of the major civilizations of Asia have grown up over the last few millennia around these rivers. And in the case of the Yellow River, it flows out across from Qinghai province to the back of the Tibetan Plateau, down through Ningxia province, down through some very arid regions to the North China Plain. And as you probably know, China's sort of divided into two very stark geographic areas. One is the very dry, arid north where wheat is grown. And the other is the very wet south of the Yangtze, where rice is grown. And the Yellow River is the reason why North China really has existed. It's the reason why great dynasties like the Tang Dynasty, the Song Dynasty, many other dynasties could survive and flourish because of the Yellow River. And you see it. It's this giant sort of serpentine flow of muddy brown water that flows across near desert in much of its upper reaches, and then down across the North China Plain and finally out into the ocean. And in the last several decades, there have been numerous years where it ceases to flow altogether at its lower reaches because so much water is extracted upstream. And much of the water, of course, is also quite polluted. Now, how does this figure all into the whole climate change equation? Well, many things have happened that you know about. Their precipitation patterns have changed, particularly on the North China Plain. Groundwater has sunk, which has made rivers even more important. But there are some other things that have happened up on the Tibetan Plateau itself, which are extremely worrisome. And since I actually left Berkeley, we have a project, the Asia Society in New York, and I've worked with this wonderfully interesting and intrepid mountain climber, and I'll show you a little short video at the end of some of his work, to try to map these glaciers and what's happening to them. So what is happening to them? One thing that we discover is that at very high altitudes, the elevation of temperatures caused by heat trapping gases is much more accelerated than at lower altitudes. And this is very complicated that some of you in the sciences will know better than I. We could get into it maybe in question and answer period. But this means that whatever happens down below, and you may hear an average of a temperature rise around the world of 1%, below 1%, whatever it may be, up there, it's a lot higher because you're getting an average of the extremes at both ends. So the first thing that this triggers, of course, is an increased rate of melt of these glaciers. It also means that because the air is warmer, less snow falls. So what used to fall as snow to accumulate on the glaciers and to be trapped in these sort of frozen reservoirs runs off. And it throws the whole balance. There's a thing amongst glaciologists called equilibrium, where the zone, the accumulation zone at the top of the glacier accumulates a certain amount, and the ablation zone at the bottom, where the glacier calves off and sends, you know, big sort of chunks of ice rolling down the mountains or melting, this is all thrown out of whack. So the glacier not only begins to melt and become shorter, but it ceases to be able to regenerate and to accumulate. Another very interesting thing is happening, which is even sort of more, I think, worrisome. There's been some very interesting scientific work done, particularly down at the University of California at San Diego, on what's called, atmospheric brown clouds. And what these are, particularly over the Indian subcontinent, are great clouds of pollution that are generated by particulate matter, among other things, that come from the burning of coal, come from diesel engines. And any of you who've been in India on the highway, you know what it is to travel behind any vehicle that's spewing great toxic clouds of black diesel exhaust out the back. And these go up in the air, and they have two very complicated effects. One, the black carbon absorbs heat. But there are other particulate matter particulate matter particles in suspension, in this sort of aerosol suspension, that reflect heat. Nitrates, sulfates, things of that nature. They're like little mirrors. And in fact, people in speaking about sort of engineering fixes for climate change often ponder spraying the atmosphere with certain kinds of sulfur particles to reflect heat back out. But these ultimately fall back down to Earth. The particulate matter, I'll tell you its odyssey in a moment, but the strange effect of these atmospheric black clouds is both in a certain way to heat up certain levels of the atmosphere, but also to mask degrees of global warming that would already have happened if the reflective capacity of these clouds wasn't at work. So the climate has been forced, but if the atmospheric brown clouds ever get cleaned up, which they should because they're tremendous health risks, there will be a sudden jump in the elevation of temperatures because you'll lose that reflective capacity. So there's a kind of a push and a pull going on here. The other thing that happens is when the monsoon sweeps across the Indian subcontinent, it takes up this particulate matter into the Himalaya ice fields, and it deposits it on the glaciers. And because more of that moisture is now falling as rain, it means that it is settling on top of glaciers. It never gets buried by a clean level of snow, a clean layer of snow. And it means that it is building up a kind of a darker surface on these glaciers that acts like a solar collector, increasing the melt rate of the glaciers, diminishing its ablative effect, its ability to radiate heat back out into the into space. So this is another reason why the glaciers are sort of under threat. And who would have ever thought that these incredible sort of Moby Dicks of the the geological world that seem so massive and so invincible would ever come under the threat from anthropogenic changes such as climate change. But there you have it. So this very fragile, once rather forgotten area suddenly assumes an enormous importance to all of Asia. And we've talked about many things here today, but you know, one that certainly can't be ignored is, of course, food security. And the threat about people being displaced because rivers cease to act as they've always acted in the past, and countries going to war. One of the things that the world does not yet have in any significant measure is transnational agencies capable of adjudicating what happens in these rivers. And now China is building scores of dams, not only throughout Tibet, these rivers that flow down to Pakistan, India, Burma, and elsewhere, but also on the Mekong, because that's in China before it goes down through Southeast Asia. So there are all sorts of threats to stable, reliable water supplies that grow out of the really unknown effects yet to be charted of climate change. And this creates a tremendous sense of anxiety for all of these countries which are downstream from the sort of catchment area, which is, in some sense, the frozen reservoirs of the Tibetan Plateau. So this, in a sense, as I suggested at the beginning, is kind of a metaphor for a very delicately calibrated system that we never really even thought about. It just did its thing. And civilizations adjusted to it, and populations adjusted to it. And now, if it gets thrown out of kilter, we could have a tremendous amount of social dislocation, and even, I think, the possibility of countries going to war over water, because there really is nothing more important. There's nothing you can't replace water with something else as you can replace oil with sun, wind, tide, whatever else. There's no alternative. and particularly as more and more water becomes polluted, this relatively pure water that's flowing down from this very remote region in the Tibetan Plateau is more precious than ever. And you begin to see within China itself now projects to remedy the imbalances that are being created by growing populations, diminished rainfall, and other aberrant kinds of weather pattern changes. We have a thing called the Nanshui Beidia, the South-North Water Transfer Project, which Majun had a little map on it. You may have missed it. It basically is of if you decided you were going to replumb your house. China is replumbing itself by hooking up the Yangtze River with the Yellow River in North China in what is the largest engineering project ever executed by mankind. And there are originally three channels planned. They finished one along the old Grand Canal. There's another one that's come a little to the north. And this is to bring water to the parched north, the big cities like Beijing, Tianjin, many, many others that are sucking groundwater out at an alarming rate. And they're not able to replenish surface supplies because there isn't adequate rainfall. And rainfall patterns have also changed. So we get a whole series of attendant knock-on effects that happen when climate adjusts just a little bit and when things like the reservoirs of Asia, the frozen reservoirs of Asia, get perturbed by climate change. Now, let's just, I think I'll stop here. That's kind of a very quick thumbnail sketch of one problem that's intimately related to climate change. One other very alarming aspect to this whole proposition on the Tibetan Plateau is, of course, as temperatures are elevated, permafrost thaws. And permafrost has frozen the grasslands of the Qinghai province sort of area and higher elevations in Tibet so that they haven't been able to biodigest the organic matter in the soil and release methane. And as you all know, methane is some 20 times more harmful as a heat-trapping gas even than carbon. And now, with the elevated temperatures, permafrost is melting, and the pastures are drying out, and this biodigestion is going on, and methane is being released. This is almost even more worrisome a source of greenhouse gas than even industrial emissions. Now, I don't want to depress you too much. Let me leave you. These are beautiful mountains. It's a magnificent landscape. And we have done a lot of work up there and have a whole exhibit of photographs that we've taken around the world. And I want to show you just one quick little few-minute video of this mountain climber that I've worked with, made several films with, that we've been doing this project. We call it Coal Plus Ice, which really charts the carbon arc from the coal mine to the factory to the atmosphere to the mountains, elevated temperatures, glaciers, rivers, and then, of course, ultimately back into the ground. And we have this magnificent photographer who does pictures of hurricane waves off New York because it all comes home to roost somewhere, somehow, for everyone. And in New York's case, the increased instances of very aberrant extreme weather.
Summer of 2007, I was approached by Marty Smith, a producer at Frontline, making a two-hour program called Heat, on the business of global warming. And he wanted images of melting glaciers in the Himalayas. I knew of a picture Mallory had taken of the north side of Everest in 1921. Beautiful, iconic photo. It makes this fantastic S-turn right up to the accumulation zone at the base of the north face of Everest. I was interested in that photo for two reasons. First, I knew how to get there. Second, it was a photograph taken by George Mallory, the famous mountaineer who coined the phrase, because it's there. He was on three expeditions to Everest, 1921-22, and he died high on Everest in 1924 with his companion Andrew Irvin. So Marty and I went up to Rongbuk Monastery at the base of Everest, and he sent me off up the mountain with my Pentax camera and two monks as my porters, and we found Mallory's photo point. Right away, we knew these glaciers had melted a lot. There in front of me, I was holding Mallory's photo in black and white from 1921. I could immediately see the results. In fact, the glacier we were looking at, the main Rongbuk Glacier, had already melted 300 or 400 feet vertically in the span of 88 years. And if that glacier hadn't shown such extreme and accelerating melt rate, the project, for me, probably would have ended there.
Well, that just gives you a little taste. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
While they're getting settled, on a personal note, my first encounter with Orville was in the Tibetan Plateau, just a little below 16,000 feet on a pass. I was with Galen Rowell on a trip, and he was leading a trip, and we met for the first time in Qinghai Province. I wish I had thought of a good reason to keep going back there, like you've done. Okay, so while the questions are coming in, they're passing cards around. I have a couple questions. In the United States, when we've come up with a number of approaches to dealing with global warming, but they get nowhere because of the politics. Our leadership is not able to do things that are, you know, could be win-win solutions. We have maybe it's a naive and it's an illusion, but we have this sense, I at least do, that in China, if the leadership wanted to do something about fossil fuel emissions, they could just do it, assuming it's technically feasible. Is that an illusion, or is that a real accurate portrayal of the capacity of the Chinese leadership?
I think in every country, the political capital is limited, and whether they're going to choose to do this or that. And in China, I think the economic growth definitely is trumping other issues, and it's a matter of considered a matter of legitimacy and all this. So keeping up the economic growth is taken as very important, and when it comes to local government, they definitely, most of them, still put GDP growth rate ahead of environmental protection. It's just not just matters to the review of their performance, to the promotion opportunities, but also in increasingly the money and power goes hand in hand, just like in many parts of the world, and so the vested interest is building up, and it's very, very difficult to change that when it comes to this whole big issue of climate change. If we only, I think, come up from the carbon perspective, it won't be quite easy to cross the message in this country. It won't be quite easy to cross message in our part of the world as well. And when you come to the global level, you know, it leads to what we saw in Copenhagen when we got stuck there, developing world, versus the developed. And there's all this, especially China, America got stuck there. And but now there has been some very interesting local dynamic going on. The local pollution, Ovo mentioned about this. But Ovo, I feel somewhat differently. You I don't know how much time you're going to spend in Beijing, but as a resident, I really feel very strongly, you know, about this. I worried about my child, and many of us worried about our children. And with the data, we understand that its surrounding regions got even worse air quality, but they just, you know, for a long time don't know about that. And now, you know, with the push for transparency, you know, from the beginning of this year, we started getting real-time disclosure every hour for 74 cities. And now 114 cities in our country can give people access to information on real-time monitoring data. You know, we can check on our cell phone with the app, you know, 35 monitoring stations. But unfortunately, most of the days, it's not healthy for outdoor exercises, for outdoor activities. We as adults, we can stop. We can, you know, turn to indoor activities. But our children are still pushed in schools, you know, for outdoor exercises and sports class, playing football. You know, we all feel really painful. But with this new kind of a revelation disclosure, finally, the government decided to create emergency response plans saying that the school could stop outdoor exercises. And you may have learned that just a couple of weeks ago, we got some cities even stopped the whole school during the bad smoggy days in North China. And of course, it's very helpful to prevent further exposure to these hazards. But people are not satisfied just to learn, you know, which day I'm going to put on face mask or lock my children indoor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough. So people demand for solutions, for actions, and the government eventually responded to that with, you know, by changing, by revising again and again, with you know, ever more, increasingly more ambitious action plans. And so far, the new version, the most updated version, stating that in areas surrounding Beijing, Beijing, Tianjin, and Hebei, three, you know, provincial level areas, the coal consumption must be reduced by 80 million tons a year. 80 million tons of coal. You know, so just thinking about this is probably bigger than most in the consumption of most of the countries in the world. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about how, you know, if we can come up with something integrated, an integrated solution. You know, there's a good way to do it or a bad way. You know, bad way is to push all these coal power plants to, you know, further places, to build that in Inner Mongolia, for example. I mean, that won't be a good solution. You know, that helps local pollution control, but, you know, when it comes to global level, it's not very helpful. So we need to integrate it, but this created a huge dynamic in our country. You know, to start it with, finally, talking about a cap, a peak of our coal consumption. And then with that, you know, there's definitely no way to find alternatives to power all this inefficient industry. So we need to restructure our industry. So the disclosure of the finest particles have actually led to such a snowballing effect. There's a new dynamic in our country. If we can seize that moment, you know, China is taking action, and if we work together on that, so just talking about the carbon issue, I don't think that's going to, you know, lead to such a kind of change. But with the local dynamic, you know, in your country, move to natural gas, so you move forward as well. So I think there's a chance for both of us to come up with some to take advantage of this.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to diminish the hazards of the pollution in China, but just to say that I think it can be fixed, whereas I'm not sure about climate change. And as to your question, you know, about people like to imagine China's a nice little dictatorship. They just wave wands and things get done. It's not that easy. They do have better capacity to execute policy, but then anybody would have better possibilities of executing policy than our own national government. I should say that here in California, things are not so unhopeful.
In fact, I am working with Governor Brown now to write for him in the state of California a concrete plan for how to collaborate with a province in China to create a model for resolving some issues relating to climate change. That's very hopeful. So I feel like I don't want to go to Washington. Useless, hopeless. But here in California, actually, there are some prospects to actually do something.
Okay, thank you. This is a question for Orville, and I'm not sure. I'll ask it. I think it'll be fun. Why would Vietnam go to war with China over the Mekong any more than Mexico would go to war with the U.S. over the Colorado River?
Well, Vietnam, the Mekong flows out down at the bottom of Vietnam, and the whole of the Mekong Delta is in Vietnam. There are millions of people dependent upon it. I don't know. They went to war in 1979 over basically nothing. You could imagine that the water question might actually be a real national interest, which could put two nations at each other's throat.
Yeah. Okay. makes sense. Marjan, this is a question for you. What could the U.S. do besides confer a Goldman Award to make your job easier?
I think there's a lot that we can do together. I mean, on a global level, obviously, we for quite some time use each other as an excuse, and I think we need to change that with the new dynamic. We could change that, and then back on the issue of all this, what I talk about our good dynamic going on. Having said that, the enforcement going to be really challenging. How to implement such a plan? It will really affect a lot of interests. Hebei province alone need to cut their coal consumption by 40 million, and that means that their iron steel capacity need to be reduced by, one third of that need to be canceled and abolished. And that means 60 million tons of coal, of iron steel capacity. how many factories, and employment and all this fiscal income, it's going to impact them. So there are a lot of, difficulties to implement this. But as I highlighted the fact that increasingly all this data would be available, and of course, not just they will not just stay. Hopefully, not just stay in China. We generate all this data, we compile the data into this platform, and from next year, I would say that all these major emitters, in China, 65% of our air emission comes from just a number of 4,189 factories. Mm. Can you believe that? It's just that number. And if we can, from next year, hopefully, many of them would give hourly disclosure. Some of the provinces started trying that, and we are capturing all this hourly data. And you know what? Some of them break the discharge standards almost like every hour. So if we can, behind that, what is going on? I mentioned about our new site, which can allow the investors to pull out this data of listed companies, and we can we also going to allow people to understand who are the investors, who are the shareholders of all these polluting factories, who are the banks which provide the long-term loans to them. Of course, most of them are Chinese. We're going to push them, but there are also these major investors from U.S., from Europe, and all of this, just like the brands. So if we care, if we do care about this issue, then, we can do something on this part of the world. When we engage with the investors, saying that, look, do you want to know how your money powered the dirtiest some factories in China? And of course, they're not just generating local pollution. They're also major carbon emitters in the world. But unfortunately, quite some of them say that, we don't know. We don't want to know. We just care about return of investment. So we cannot engage them successfully. So we're looking for partners in this part of the world to say that, you know, if we all care, then we can do something like that. So I hope that that we can, you know, take advantage, seize the opportunity to do that.
Thank you. David has asked me to ask you to make the answer to this next one very short, because we're short on time.
Sorry.
And it's kind of a cruel thing to make you answer briefly, but here's the question. Does China have a population policy moving forward into the future? What are its goals, and is it necessary to have such a policy if it's going to deal with global warming and with air and water quality?
You know, when it comes to population policy, China has for all these years, you know, having a very imposed a very stringent, you know, population policy. And I have to say some that this generation of Chinese actually, you know, sacrifice a lot for that. People could have all kind of thinking about this, but the matter of fact, I mean, one real impact is that for the, you know, it does reduce several hundred million, you know, possible, you know, population by several hundred million. So, but now China is aging very, very quickly, and there's many, you know, professionals started, you know, arguing that this policy is going to cause a lot of huge social problems if we don't change on time. But we, again, have vested interest, you know, agencies which are quite, even still resist this. Mm-hmm. So the debate has just get started. And I guess we need to hit the balance.
Orville, do you want to add anything?
Well, it's a very difficult dilemma for China. You know, 1964, China had half as many people as it does now. At that point, Mao Zedong declared China's population its atom bomb. And it exploded. And since cooler heads have prevailed, they have this very draconian one child, one family, one child policy. And yet, now they're having this huge balloon of elderly people with inadequate younger people to support them. So it's an incredibly difficult problem that is going to cause some real dislocations down the line.
Okay. Let's thank our speakers.
Thank you very much to Majun and to Orville. That really brought us to some important and challenging points to looking forward. We've come to the last event of the day. It's actually the one I've been looking forward to in many ways the most. And we've invited six students from the Graduate School of Journalism to join us on stage and share their impressions of the stories that they heard from the speakers and the discussions, and to challenge us to think about how we communicate these important issues to the broader public. So to moderate this final panel, I am pleased to introduce Edwin Dobb from the Graduate School of Journalism. He's a member of our advisory committee and an active participant in planning today's program. And Mr. Dobb is a former editor at The Sciences and an independent writer and environmental journalist whose work has appeared in Harper's, The New York Times, National Geographic, and other publications. He's an active participant in our night program in environmental journalism here at Berkeley, and also an adjunct professor in the environmental studies program at the University of Montana. This semester, he's teaching a class, Telling Environmental Stories, and he's invited six students from that class to join us today for the end of the program. Edwin, and please join us.
So it's been a long day, and we are running a little late. I don't know about you, but I'm overwhelmed in a good way by the discussion. And we certainly, I think, I speak for the group, got a lot of ideas for stories, or at least got a lot of ideas. Let me just quickly say that my colleague and I, Mark Shapiro from the Journalism School, were terrifically pleased to find that the planning group was not only multidisciplinary, and was forced by Graham Fleming to figure out how to work together, which was, he's kind of an evil genius that way. And it worked. But also to learn that this group was truly committed to reaching out to society to make its expertise available to the community, to the... Okay. To make it the expertise, the considerable expertise and experience of the Berkeley community to society at large, decision makers, policy makers, and the public, and not only to identify and assess potential impacts of global climate change, but actually to help society prepare for it, mitigate its effects, compensate, and so on. So Mark and I, on behalf of the Journalism School, we're really pleased to be part of this effort. So we see this today, although we've gone through this months-long planning process, as actually the beginning of a conversation between the Journalism School and journalism on the Berkeley campus and the rest of the campus around this most urgent issue. And the conversation today then is that in the spirit of the start of this process of collaboration, see where it might go. I'm going to quickly introduce the six students who are generous enough to come today, and then we're going to ask a couple of questions about stories and ideas and see where we get, and then you cut us off when we've run out of time. Okay, on my immediate left, I got Zach St. George. This is, and then Tanya Dimitrova, Mateo Hoke, Gene Spencer, Tawanda Kanhima, and Eric Newman. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to go one at a time and ask them about possible story ideas that they picked up during the course of the day. So, Zach. And or any particular ideas, revelations, anything that impressed you about what you saw today?
Yeah, you know, I think all of you that I watched speak, you know, all really working on some interesting things. I think some of you did an especially good job of disguising that sometimes. No, but really the thing that I kept hearing over and over again that really stood out to me was this idea of climate change as, you know, often the way we're going to see it is a local issue. And yet I think the solutions a lot of the time are going to need to be global, and still working on how to overcome that, but...
Well, I was impressed and inspired by some really ingenious ideas from the flood defense panel, for example. Christina Hill mentioned a lot of work that's been done. For example, in Japan, they are building super dikes, and people, instead of living behind the dike, live on top of the dike. And this way, they use the water, as the dike is bigger, it's less likely to break. Or people in Hamburg, where they have an entire part of the city, Hafen District, which is built, prepared for flooding. All the buildings, actually the living quarters, start one floor off the ground, and the underground garages are waterproof. And there are sidewalks one level above, so people can actually use the space, and they're not really looking at flooding events as something really dangerous and scary. And she actually had a picture of parents taking their children out to play by the water of the flood, which is kind of unthinkable in places like, I guess, along the Mississippi Delta.
Yeah, again, I'd like to kind of echo the statements of Zach and that, you know, not being able to sit on every panel is, of course, a natural disadvantage. But what I did hear was a lot of phenomenal research being done, and it's important research that I think the journalists up here care a lot about. That's why we're in this class. That being said, the way the information is presented is vital to the stories that we tell and the way you convey that information to us and then to a larger audience. If your graphics are hard to read, your graphics are terrible. Like, they need to be redone. And if you have to think about a graphic, it needs to be redone. Please look online, go to KDMC website, get some tutorials on how to build graphics. It's important. These stories can be told in much more concise ways through visual elements, and that's why you guys use PowerPoint so much. I'll just leave it at that. As far as stories go, just a quick, unsolicited advice. It helps us. It really does. It helps us tell stories to a broader audience. As far as a story idea goes, the idea of reimagining the bay and how we build houses along the bay, potentially using the resources of the wealthy to protect more vulnerable elements of our population from flooding, I found very fascinating.
Jean?
So I have no advice, but two things that kind of jumped out at me. One was the carbon credits for family planning. I think it's a great idea. and another one, this is a little bit more wonky and obscure, but I was really interested in the pricing predictability, because I think when you're talking about water, people don't want to pay more. But then they're left depending on unpredictable water supplies. And if you're able to put a price on what that really costs people, I think that's an interesting angle. I think it's hard to convey. They were discouraging me from this story because it's very abstract. But I mean, I think when you look at LA, which is a city that has, it's so dependent on external water. It's dependent on its aqueducts. And you can kind of try to bring in some dramatic events that could potentially affect those aqueducts, such as an earthquake or an act of terrorism, a tragic mistake on an aqueduct that would cut off LA from just a huge proportion of its water, to really bring home this idea of how important local sources of water are, such as recycled or reused water, and also the predictability, like water that you can count on, and how much that really can be worth. I thought that was a really interesting angle.
Okay. I sat in on the physical design innovations panel, and I think it was really inspiring to find that we're moving forward from just bemoaning the fact that climate change is changing the way people can use the land, people can access water, and moving on to design, sort of how do we respond to this problem. I listened to a presentation on solutions that authorities and private institutions in Africa are taking to solve the water problem. And I find it quite notable that 4 billion people have no access to continuous water. They have no access to continuous water. And at least, I think, close to a billion of those people are in Africa, where we have 900 million people, mostly rural communities, people without access to water. So I would like to hear more about the solutions that private institutions and governments are putting into place to sort of recover the water that's being lost to waste.
Eric? I just wanted to say thanks to everybody for the presentations. They were really great today. It was very impressive. I enjoyed all the presentations I went to. It was really encouraging to see an interest in people who are in a very academic setting wanting to translate some of these ideas to the general public. I think I heard that a couple different times about an interest in communicating these issues that are so pertinent to everyone. I was surprised just to learn about the seemingly total lack of regulation of groundwater, definitely here in California and in other places. And in terms of a story, I was interested in something that Malcolm Potts was describing in his presentation. And if I were to write a story, I might call it "The Iran Solution: Does a Muslim Family Planning Strategy Hold the Solution to Global Overpopulation?" That was my biggest takeaway. But just wanted to say thanks.
Thank you very much, Ed, and all of the students who joined us. We're just going to wrap up very quickly, and I'll let David Sedlak have a few words first.
Great. So thank you all for sticking out the whole day. Thank you to our sponsors of the meeting for making this happen, and thank you to all the speakers for what they've managed to accomplish today. We just wanted to take a few minutes to summarize, and again, I got charged with helping to end this on a high note so you don't all go away depressed on a Friday night. And so this morning, we heard some sobering facts about climate change and its effect on water and the hydrologic cycle. And we heard from some people who are on the front lines of climate change's effects on water and the challenges that it poses to our existing institutions. And it kind of set a tone that was pretty sober. And I blame Bill for not putting any pictures of puppies in his presentation. But there were a couple of nuggets that I thought were very positive that I'm going to take home with me and think about over the weekend and in the future. And the first one was a figure that Peter Glick showed us, and it was an exponential curve. And he talked about an exponential curve of population and an exponential curve of carbon dioxide and many of the other bad things that exponential curves imply. But it also means that there are more gifted scientists and engineers and planners and people engaged in public policy alive now than have ever been alive before. And there are more computing speed and more tools and technology and social media for addressing these problems. And so if the problem is solvable, it's solvable because of that exponential curve. And that's one of the great things that the university does. It rides this exponential curve at the front end of it and offers solutions to society. The other thing that I saw today that I thought was impressive and gave me hope was maybe thinking about if we tried to convene this meeting 25 years ago with people from the same disciplines, and it would have felt like three or four separate meetings going on simultaneously, because the language that people would have used and their understanding of the problem would have been completely different. And even though we each approach this from the lens of our own disciplines, we're starting to see the problems the same way, and we're starting to share a common language for discussing it. And I think this is the perfect time to do truly interdisciplinary research and leverage the skills of the many talented people at Berkeley to make a major difference. So there you go. That's two things that you can take home with you and maybe end on a higher note. David, don't blow it.
First, I want to say very quickly, as they say, if you didn't read the book, you can wait for the movie. So if you missed anything today, I want to thank our audiovisual crew. Everything will be on YouTube and an iTunes U sort of course for the long term. And since you could only go to one of the panels, your assignment is to go home. And when these come out, go watch the other panel. So thank you very much for all the equipment. Very nice job. Many years ago, I remember reading an essay of literary criticism, and it said that only fiction can tell the truth. And it's actually stuck with me as a very powerful statement. All of us are in our disciplines, we're in our silos, and of necessity, if I'm going to study biology, then I don't understand fully the climate. And if Max is studying the economics, he can only tackle the biology, well, he tackles biology better than most economists, we know that. But when we go into our silos, we necessarily, paradoxically, by searching for this great understanding, we necessarily can't tell the truth, because we're only allowed to speak on that on which we have expertise. And this is true of fiction. Fiction tells a truth. And why do we read great books? Because they tell great truths. And we read journalism because it can tell the truth, because it does not have to respect those boundaries. And I think one of those opportunities that is there is to weave this story together and tell that truth. This is the challenge that we face in the university. And many of us, and I feel like I'm quite early in my own career here in trying to see what it really means to tackle interdisciplinary problems and what it really means to reach across those boundaries and find the actual truth that weaves us together. The world's problems don't respect disciplinary boundaries, and we know that. And they are of necessity, and they are in and of themselves integrated. And we've parsed them up into pieces, and then we try to tackle them, and we wonder why we have so much trouble. So I hope that my positive note will be just, I hope that especially for students and postdocs, younger researchers, that you see that we're at a great moment to reach across the aisle, reach across disciplines, and really try to seek a deeper understanding and move forward with solutions to these great problems. I want to thank the Phil Mathieu Foundation again. I want to thank all of you and all of the speakers for what was a very, very enjoyable day. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.